Tonight on the Daily Debrief, in Florida, a fight over privacy.
That's not what the Constitution requires in any part of this country.
Key evidence is thrown out of court in the prostitution case against Robert Kraft. Plus, a restaurant owned by golfer Tiger Woods is in legal trouble. Also in South Carolina, this man is accused of murdering his five children.
What he did was he thought, I'm screwed.
But the defense pleads insanity.
Tim's mind is broken.
And in Vermont, another insanity case as experts try to help keep a man out of prison after he killed five teenagers. Real life cases are happening nationwide. This is the Daily Debrief for Tuesday, May 14th.
And good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Daily Debrief here on the Law and Crime Network. The state of Florida's case against New England Patriots owner Robert Kraft is now a lot more difficult or maybe even impossible. A judge has thrown out of court the hotly contested surveillance video, which authorities say shows Kraft receiving sexual stimulation during a massage.
If we had something that was illegal, it was going to be obvious.
You're looking into the prying eyes of a detective who watched a video feed of customers inside a Florida massage parlor. Some were said to be paying for sex. Others were not.
She came in and fairly quickly I realized that this was probably going to be a legit massage based on her demeanor.
Defense attorneys for Robert Kraft convinced a Florida judge that the police operation was unconstitutional.
I think they said, which I have no reason to dispute, they were trying to maintain the dignity and respect and concern for the dignity and respect of these people. The fact is, that's not what the Constitution requires in any part of this country.
The search warrant which authorized the sting did not require police to minimize their intrusion into each patron's privacy, and police did little to minimize intrusion on their own.
The instructions on minimization have to be put in the affidavit and or the warrant. It has to be very clear and set out and explain what it is you do to prevent innocent people or innocent conduct from being captured.
The judge said detectives here simply saw and recorded too much. The spa advertised services for women clients, and in fact, more than one woman had a significant portion of her spa time viewed by a detective, and the entirety of her spa time recorded and placed in Jupiter Police Department records. Failing to consider and include instructions on minimizing the impact on women is a serious flaw in the search warrant. The judge's order went on to criticize the viewing and recording of the legitimate massages of male clients as well. Prosecutors unsuccessfully tried to convince the judge that they did minimize their intrusion.
Officers want as much evidence as they can get. They called us on the phone. They told us what we had. We said shut it down because 4.5 days was plenty.
The judge suppressed the recording and the subsequent traffic stop, which identified Kraft. Without that evidence, the prosecutor has no case.
Kraft's attorneys are now arguing that the recording cannot be released under state open records law because it was not constitutionally obtained. So joining me tonight, Judge Ashley Wilcott is here from Georgia. Judge, good to see you again on the Debrief.
Thank you, Aaron. Hi.
Okay, good to see you, as I said. So let's boil this all down here. Is there any shot whatsoever that the state can win this case? Remember, Robert Kraft was charged with soliciting a prostitute, basically encouraging that. Is there any shot that they can push this case forward without this key evidence?
I think the only shot is if the person who did the act or allegedly did the act testifies against him. That would be direct evidence that this happened. Absent that, Aaron, I don't know that they have the evidence to proceed to prove it by beyond a reasonable doubt.
And look, if I'm remembering my facts properly, they did go ahead and go after that person. So is it possible we could see some kind of a deal, see that witness flip, and then watch this move forward?
Absolutely. I think you're spot on right. And that is, they may get a deal in order to testify against him. And if that's the case, again, that's the best direct evidence in lieu of a videotape. So it might go forward.
Okay. One big question here. Is the state going to appeal this particular decision here? Because obviously the state would like to have that evidence. I anticipate an appeal here, which says, look, the police did what the law was in this state, and now we have this local judge and we have another local judge in another jurisdiction in a similar sting operation, basically ruling within a couple of days of one another that, no, we're going to bring federal law from another circuit into Florida and say that's the law here. Police didn't know that that was what they had to do. That's why they didn't do it. And appeals court, throw this out and let us use the video. Do you anticipate that happening?
Well, I know you and I have gone back and forth about this a little bit, Aaron. Yes, I do think it's reasonable to think that the state will appeal for that very reason. And keep in mind, this is how laws are made and how laws go away in different states. And so the court said in its opinion, listen, I am looking at federal law that is instructive only, right? It's not law in the state of Florida, nor is it from our federal circuit. But I'm going to look outside of the circuit. I'm going to find it's instructive and make this ruling. This is a perfect case for the state to appeal because of that.
Exactly. Okay. And Judge, you sit on the bench. Sometimes you get a little bit nervous when you try to import that law in from another area, especially another federal circuit. But bottom line, we're still interpreting the same constitution here.
Absolutely. And Aaron, here's where I'm so proud of this decision is number one, the way it's written, because it's very full of facts and well-reasoned. And quite frankly, as a judge, if I'm going to make a decision, I want to ensure that all of the reasons for my decision are laid out carefully in the opinion, because certainly parties have a right to appeal and I want them to do that. But I sure want the Court of Appeals to know what I was relying on.
Exactly. Okay, Judge Wilcott, real quickly here, should the suppression order, should it stand? Should the video never be released because of the presumption that it was unconstitutionally obtained despite state open records law?
That's what I think. I absolutely think that it should be suppressed, and it, in spite of those laws, absolutely agree.
Judge Ashley Wilcott will be back with you again here in a couple of minutes. A restaurant owned by golf star Tiger Woods is being sued. The restaurant is managed by Woods' girlfriend, Erica Herman. The case alleges that 24-year-old Nicholas Imusberger drank too much at the restaurant and died in a subsequent car crash with a blood alcohol level of 0.256. The suit claims the staff at the restaurant knew Imusberger had a drinking problem, knew he had been in a previous crash, knew they'd been told not to serve him, and even destroyed surveillance footage of Imusberger drinking. A Houston man under arrest regarding the presumed death of his ex-fiancee's daughter has had his bond reduced. Darian Vance is charged with tampering with evidence, a human corpse, after reporting 4-year-old Malia Davis missing more than a week ago. Inside the apartment where the girl lived, police court records say they have DNA which matches Malia's DNA. Authorities also have surveillance footage showing Vance carrying a full garbage bag out of that apartment. He also was seen with bottles of bleach. A judge reduced the original bond of about $1 million down to $45,000. Opening statements today in a death penalty case out of South Carolina. Prosecutors there have charged Timothy Jones Jr. with killing his 5 children, ages 1 through 8, and then driving around with their bodies for more than a week. They say this defendant strangled 4 of his kids and beat another one to death. Jones is arguing insanity. A jury of 10 women and 8 men will decide his fate. That's before they cut out the alternates. Here is how the state presented its case.
A child should be saved in a father's arms. It's a simple statement, and it's a true statement. But Tim Jones' 5 children were not safe in his arms. Mira Gracie Jones, 8 years old, murdered by her father, August 28, 2014. Elias Jones, her brother, 7 years old, murdered by his father with his hands. Natan Jones, 6 years old, killed at his father's hands, August 28, 2014. Gabriel Jones, 2 years old, killed at his father's hands, August 28, 2014. And the baby Abigail, 1 year old, murdered by her father. Saturday, September 6, 2014, at about 9 o'clock, Tim Jones, driving his Escalade, is stopped at a traffic safety checkpoint in Smith County, Mississippi. He is arrested for driving under the influence and possession of synthetic cannabinoids. The children are not with him, and the car smells like death. He's taken into custody, and over the course of a few days, he's interviewed, and ultimately, he leads the police to the bodies of his children, each one wrapped in a garbage bag on the side of the road in the middle of nowhere.
The defense used an analogy to draw jurors into the insanity defense.
I've got a friend who works at the Forestry Commission. He always says, you can't judge the health of a forest by only looking at a few trees. That is what the state is going to ask you to do in this trial, is to just look at a few trees. They're not going to ask you to look at the seeds that the forest was planted with. They're not going to ask you to test the soil to see if the foundation of that forest is poor. You heard the judge say that Tim has pled not guilty by reason of insanity. Now, it's not a defense that Tim picked out, like when you were in voir dire and the judge read you a list of defenses. That is a defense that the lawyers, in consultation with experts, a full examination of Tim, and a review of his family history. Tim has schizophrenia, something he wasn't diagnosed with prior to his arrest. Tim's mind is broken. In deciding whether Tim knew the legal or moral right from wrong, you need to look at the full forest, not just a few trees.
Back once again to discuss this case, Judge Ashley Wilcott from Georgia. So, Judge, let's talk about this analogy here. Does this analogy work, this, don't just look at a couple of trees here, look at the whole forest, and in other words, find this guy legally insane, therefore not someone you can convict?
Well, here's the problem I have with that analogy. Absolutely agree that there are a lot of issues. He's had a traumatic brain injury. He's been diagnosed after with schizophrenia. But that does not mean necessarily that he did not know right from wrong at the time he killed all five of his children and killed them in a horrible way, by the way. So, those don't necessarily go hand in hand. The defense has to prove that they do.
Yeah, I mean, strangling four kids to death and then beating another, I mean, that's one by one by one. Somewhere in there, we hear the prosecutor off the top of the show saying, and I quote, he realized he was screwed. I mean, did he have some moment in here where he knew he was in trouble, as the prosecutor alleges, and therefore can be convicted?
Well, I think if that's the case, and he in fact beat one to death and then strangled the rest because they were witnesses, that's an example of, to me, what would prove that he definitely knew right from wrong, or he would not have taken those subsequent actions and killed four more of his children.
Slice and dice the statute there, Judge Wilcott. We're going to continue to talk about this case as it rolls along. It's still ahead tonight here on The Debrief, the case of horror on the highway. Experts present their diagnoses of the man who admits to driving in the wrong lane on the interstate, killing five teens. Will an insanity defense keep him out of prison? We'll discuss that one after the break. Welcome back to the case of horror on the highway, where a Vermont man is accused of murdering five high school students. Stephen Burgoyne is facing five counts of second-degree murder, one count of aggravated operation, and one count of gross negligence. This police reconstruction shows how authorities believe Burgoyne sped down the interstate in the wrong lane, swerved to the left, and slammed head-on into a vehicle carrying five high school friends. None of the victims of that massive crash survived. One died at age 15, the others were age 16. After the first crash, Burgoyne stole a responding police car, took off, turned around, and then caused a second crash.
Now we got a person trapped in the car. Pull the fire extinguisher. Who's got my car?
And that was just a small piece of the squad car footage, which shows Burgoyne taking off in that police SUV after the first crash. He turned it around, drove back into the previous wreckage, at an estimated speed of 103 miles per hour. Testifying last week was Burgoyne's ex-girlfriend and the mother of his daughter. Anila Lawrence covered her face just after taking her oath and appeared to be uncontrollably shaking on the witness stand. She described an instance where Burgoyne took off with her and their baby in the back of his car and threatened to crash into a pond. That's if she did not agree to a 50-50 custody. That incident unrelated to the deaths of the teens. But the question for the jury is whether Burgoyne was legally sane or legally insane. Here is a defense psychiatrist giving his opinion.
He had bipolar disorder with psychotic features, rapid cycling, meaning a certain number of episodes per year. That was his diagnosis.
You believe that he lacked the adequate capacity either to, let's start with first, and believe he could appreciate the criminality of his conduct?
No.
Why not? Summary.
He did not intend to go the wrong direction and kill people or kill himself. He did not intend that. He was doing the same thing he had been doing for 2 days, which is driving around frantically, trying to preserve his life, trying to understand what he had to do next to be safe. The last day was primarily about his safety. Were they going to kill him? Were they going to kill Izzy? Were they going to burn down his house? He was trying to be safe, and he was in such a state of psychotic frenzy and confusion, and listening to the directions, his inferences from the radio and lights in the environment, that this is a simple psychotic error, not an intentional act.
Another psychiatrist also examined the defendant, and here are her opinions.
Based on those examinations, you believe that Mr. Burgoyne has borderline personality. Is that correct?
That's my opinion, yeah.
Okay. And I believe you stated in your report that that could mimic bipolar disorder, but it is your opinion that Mr. Burgoyne does not have bipolar disorder, correct?
So the testing did not show bipolar disorder. However, in the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Mental Disorders, under both bipolar and borderline personality, it says that both could occur.
Right. But it's your opinion is that he does not have borderline personality.
So the testing didn't show that, and my opinion is that it's not inconsistent, but that's not what I found.
Okay. And with regards to borderline personality disorder, you mentioned that somebody can become psychotic in the presence of emotional discontrol. I think those were your words. Is that correct? But that someone with borderline personality disorder can also become rageful and disinhibited, correct?
Correct.
What makes this insanity defense case unique is the defendant's previous attempt, or attempts, I should say, to actually seek mental health treatment. Here's a nurse who saw Burgoyne in a hallway long before the crash.
He said one sentence, which was, "I'm looking at this poster," or "I'm just looking at this." He spoke in a normal tone of voice.
Isn't it true that this hallway is patients are sometimes permitted to walk through this hallway to get to the ED?
It is one of the ways, if you're coming from the parking garage, to get into our department, and that's where security lets you in. They ask your business, and you say, "I'm trying to get somewhere," and they let you in.
Okay. And so you weren't concerned about the fact that he was in a non-public area. People do this, right? People do show up there from time to time. Okay. So the only real suspicion you had was that made you suspicious at all was that he didn't step back when you opened the door?
He didn't. That's right. He didn't step back, and he couldn't give me a good reason for being there.
Did he give you any reason whatsoever?
He said, "I'm looking at this poster."
Do you know what poster it was?
Somebody had lost a sweatshirt, and they hung a poster up on our break room door.
A security guard approached Burgoyne in that back hallway, and what's disturbing is that this interaction may have resulted in Burgoyne not receiving treatment.
I was walking in that back hallway. I was approached by an RN in the emergency department.
You remember who?
I do.
Who's that?
Margie McLaren.
Okay. She was just in court just a minute ago? Okay. And what did she say to you?
There's a gentleman hanging out in the executive hallway.
So what did you do?
I went through those doors I had mentioned and encountered the individual at the end of the executive hallway.
Okay. Did you later figure out that person was Stephen Burgoyne?
Later, yes.
Okay. And so tell me what happened.
So he was standing in the hallway reading something on the wall. I don't remember exactly what. I approached him from behind. introduced myself, explained to me he couldn't be hanging out in that part of a hallway. He turned headwise and just, "I'm sorry, I'll just leave," and he walked down the hallway.
Judge Ashley Wilcott is back again to discuss this case and to help us sign off the broadcast here. So, Judge Wilcott, the disturbing thing about this is that had he received treatment when he was at the hospital, this might not have happened. This tragedy may have been avoided.
Yeah, I agree with you, absolutely. But the other thing that bothers me is I did not hear anything, and Aaron, maybe I missed it, you may know better, indicating that when he was at the hospital, he was either suicidal or homicidal. And so I struggle with, does this really show that he was insane at the time he drove into the cars?
I don't know. And, you know, you get into all those constitutional issues when you try to involuntarily commit somebody. So, you know, even if he wasn't there really looking for treatment, like what was going on in there? They couldn't just strap him down and hold him there against his will.
No, that's right. To make sure, let me start over. The only way that you can detain someone involuntarily is if they are a threat to themselves or someone else. And in Georgia, anyways, Aaron, they have to specifically say, "I'm going to kill him. I'm going to kill myself," before they can actually do that under the law.
Yeah, exactly. Because under the Constitution, we can't just go restrain people willy-nilly. That's pretty clear. You know, I mean, there's search and seizure rules, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So what do we make of the two psychologists who were on the stand today basically saying, you know, one using the phrase that he was in a psychotic frenzy when he was involved in this entire episode that resulted in these five deaths?
Well, I think it's good argument for the defense. Now, remember, they're going to have to connect that description by those experts to the fact that he could not appreciate the criminality of his conduct, right? And I'm looking at the statute. That's why I'm looking down. So if they connect those two dots, then I think it's a really strong defense. And there, I love that you have this graphic. I love the Daily Debrief, because there they have to show, did he appreciate the criminality of his conduct, or did he know it was illegal but could not conform his conduct to the law? So if they connect those two dots, I think they've got a really strong defense.
You know, they could, and we only have about 30 seconds left. I'd love to get into a discussion, Judge Wilcott, about the mother of the child describing this entire extra episode where she says he basically threatened to kill both of them.
Right, absolutely. And you saw how emotional she was on the stand. I think that's really impactful. But does it show that he has a violent nature, or does it show he's insane? Jury decision.
Yeah, a lot to mull over there for the jury. And calling that girlfriend, that ex-girlfriend, may have backfired for the defense. We'll have to wait and see. Judge Wilcott, thanks a lot for joining us tonight. And thanks to those of you watching along at home. You can see us back here tomorrow at 5 Eastern. Good night.